We're going to attempt to do something we probably can't do, which is talk about the book of Zechariah in an hour. But what I thought I would do is give you a high-level overview of this book. This book ought to be studied and preached and taught more, and it absolutely makes no sense that it's not, other than it's kind of challenging in places. But like Daniel gets a lot of attention, and rightly so. He's got a lot of prophetic matter that people find interesting, and Zechariah has a whole lot more. By comparison, Zechariah is the most messianic of every prophet except possibly Isaiah, meaning that in every chapter is in one way or another about Jesus. And I don't mean in some way by allegorizing what I'm reading, like some people say every page of the Bible is about Jesus. I mean every chapter is about Jesus in some way. It refers to the Messiah. So it's interesting. But I'll give you an overview, and then we'll try to zero in on a few highlights and just see where it goes. If we don't finish what I'd like to finish, I'll pick it up some other time when I'm asked to lead again. But know this, you know, he's part of what we call our minor prophets. That's a Gentile phrase. It's the 12, because we have 12 minor prophets, what the rabbis would call it, from Hosea through Malachi, because they're shorter. And so we have also Zechariah and Haggai right together. Haggai is the two chapters before Zechariah. That's another prophet that doesn't get a lot of attention. He ought to. That book preaches, and it preaches easy. And one of these days I'll preach from it up there maybe if I get a chance. But Haggai is a great book. Haggai and Zechariah preach at about the same time. Haggai is an older man, and his ministry will overlap with the beginning of Zechariah's by perhaps a couple of months. Both of these prophets have very specific time markers in their books where you can actually pin it to a day. But roughly, we'll just say for our purposes right now, roughly 520 BC. So Haggai, the older guy, Zechariah, probably young when he returned from Babylon, and I'll say a little more about that, but probably a younger guy. And it seems like when Haggai's ministry maybe is winding down, we don't know, or maybe he just stopped writing, Zechariah's picks up. The emphasis of both prophets is they want the temple rebuilt. So understand that God took his people into bondage, okay, and he took the part of Israel, the northern part, first, around 722 BC, and by the Assyrians. But we're focused on that southern kingdom, what we sometimes call Judah or Judea. He takes them, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar in 605 B.C., coming and taking some people like Daniel, right? And Daniel's a young man, probably a teenager. You read about that in Daniel chapter 1, and, you know, he wouldn't eat the king's meat and all that stuff. But that's 605 B.C. Nebuchadnezzar did not overrun Jerusalem at that time. He would come back around 597. He takes the prophet Ezekiel, who's a young man who will turn 30 when he's in Babylon and begin his ministry. And we had this long book called Ezekiel. But it's because of the continued resistance that Nebuchadnezzar will come again in 586, 587 BC and destroy the city. And that's when he just completely demolishes it. One of the people that's left behind is our prophet Jeremiah. He writes a book we call Lamentations to lament the destruction of the city. So just in big picture, you can see how these prophets kind of come up through time, how they fit together. Jeremiah said, you'll go into bondage for 70 years. And people debate when that starts and ends. But what we do know is that they begin going into bondage in 605 BC. And by 539 BC, they're allowed to leave because the Babylonian Empire has come to a conclusion. That happens in the book of Daniel. You find the king, not Nebuchadnezzar, but perhaps a grandson of his, who sees the writing on the wall in the book of Daniel, the writing on the wall that says you've been found in you've been weighed and found wanting. I'll say it that way. And at that very evening, the Babylon, Babylonians lose the city. Okay, they lose Babylon to a confederacy of Medes and Persians. Those Medes and the Persians being the ones we primarily focus on, they have a different way of ruling. And they start telling the Jewish people, you can go home whenever you want. And that leads to people like Zechariah and a number of others coming back home. Ezra, Nehemiah, all these people we start reading. They're coming home to Israel. But what got accomplished through all that is the idolatry is gone. It took, basically, you take them to Babylon, and you bring a remnant back and leave the idols behind. That's basically what happened. And so when you get with Haggai and Zechariah, what they're dealing with is the people returned, not a lot of them, maybe 50,000 of them, to a city in ruins. And they returned not all to Israel. There will be people, we'll find people in some other cities we'll see in a moment, but a city in ruins. And what they did between 539 and 520 is they built houses and they built vacation homes and they bought bass boats and they fixed up their hot rod. They did it all. And that's Haggai chapter 1. Haggai says, you are living in houses that have essentially, you've built out the inside with cedar planks, which means they've gone beyond just getting shelter. Now they're living richly. And he says, but my house is still in ruins. And what they had done is they had started the foundation for the temple that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed, and then they gave up, okay? And they just stopped. And so Haggai and then Zechariah start saying, I want you to do some work. Haggai does it by turning the screws on them and saying, you got your bass boat, your vacation home, and all these things, and shame on you because you haven't built God's house. Zechariah does it in a different way. He tells them about a glorious future when Jesus rules from Jerusalem, from the temple, and says, but you haven't built it yet. Now, he'll rule from a different temple. We'll make you talk about some of that stuff. But he wants to give them a glimpse of the future to motivate them today. And that's how he proceeds. So stop me anytime you have a question. But that's just a little bit of history just to get us to Zechariah. I want to talk about how the book's organized. There's two primary culprits of bad exegesis in the Bible. One is assuming what words mean when they don't. Words don't mean what they mean when we use them at church. They mean what the writers mean when they use them in the Bible. And we often have a lot of words, like the word save, and like the word wrath, and like the word repent. We have totally made up meanings for these words. And if you just look at how they get used in the scripture without bringing it in, you know, then you'll be in a safer place. And the other thing is we don't look at how a book's organized to think about, well, what, you know, here's a section. What is Paul talking about here at a high level? That organization will really guide you. And with Zechariah, it's a very organized book, and I'll show you how. So there's a prologue up front in chapters of the first chapter, but in verses 1 through 6. And you'll notice how he starts the book. Like most prophets, he identifies himself. He says, in the 8th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, and I'm telling you that's around 520, but you can look up, and I'll mention, you know, later. I brought a few copies, but didn't have many of my little book on this. But we know exactly when this was. And some of the later time markers, he'll tell you what the day was. So we can say, okay, this was February such and such of this year. It's very helpful just for building the history. But this is the prologue. And in a nutshell, God says, remember that your fathers, the people that went into bondage, I told them what to do, and I told them what would happen if they didn't, and they did it anyway, and they died, and everything I said would happen actually happened. So you guys don't do that. That's my Texas paraphrase of that. But that's a prologue. These are called the 8 night visions, chapters 1 through 6, because there are 8 different visions, all seen in a single evening. And I had intended to bring it, and I left it at my house. I have a picture of this, an artist that he's deceased now and I used to know, but he painted all of chapters 1 through 6. I shouldn't say painted. He did them with ink pens on one canvas. He captured every vision. It's really beautiful, and there's nothing, no one else does that kind of art. But he understood all the visions happen in one night. So that's basically from chapter 1, verse 7, through the middle of chapter 6. And just as you've got a prologue, you've got a bit of an epilogue in the end of 6, and I'll show you that. But let me say, at a high level, these 8 visions are written in what we call a chiasm. So Jewish writers, and they do this frequently in the Old Testament, they like to write in a chiasm. A simple chiasm, if I had 4 principles to tell you, 1, 2, 3, 4, I would have 1, and then 2 and 3 would kind of be the same, but 1 and 4 would kind of be the same. And if you draw them, you might almost like, it's almost like you're stepping down a stairway and then stepping back the other way, because the lines that they're writing will relate to one another. And so the way it often gets written is something like A, B, C, C prime, B prime, A prime, where things relate. So what I'm saying here, Vision 1 and Vision 8 tie together in a very obvious way. And I'll show you that in a minute. Vision 2 and Vision 7, they relate. They correspond. It doesn't mean they're identical. They correspond. Vision 3 and 5, did I say that right? Yeah, 3, so 1, 2, 3. I've got a math degree and I'm not counting right. 3 and 6. Yeah. And then 4 and 5 are right in the middle, basically. And I probably left one out, but you get the idea I'm trying to do. It's an A&M math degree. But they're relating there.
That's where I went to school,
too, so you must not have. So they're written in a chiasm. Look at Vision 1, just high level. And, of course, I've got editor notes, but they have a nice note here. It says, First Vision, Horseman. I looked in the night, and I saw a man riding on a chestnut horse. He was standing among the myrtle trees in the valley, probably the Kidron Valley. Behind him were chestnut, brown, and white horses, and I asked him, What are these, my lord? And the angel who was talking to me replied, I will show you what they are. During the 8-night visions, he has a friend to help. And it is the angel that talked to him. He'll use that phrase several times. He, like us, looks at the visions and says, I have no clue what that means. And he turns to the angel that talks to him and says, What does that mean? And sometimes he gets an answer. But he's looking at this man riding on a horse that says chestnut. Other translations you may have may say red, riding on a red horse. I mean, we understand horses aren't literally red, although here it could be. But it may be a chestnut, and they've taken their, you know, they've made an interpretation there. Well, they reported to the angel of the Lord standing among the myrtle trees. I'll contend that the angel of the Lord is the man on the red horse, and he's Jesus. And I would contend that too, but I'm going to try to prove it now. But look at what they did. That is, who are they? The other horses, and by application, those who ride on them. You see in verse 10, it says, The man standing among the myrtle trees explained, They are the ones the Lord sent to patrol the earth. So he sends out, whoever's riding the red horse has sent out these other horsemen to patrol the earth and to report back. And you see that in verse 10. They've gone over the whole earth and they report that it's calm and quiet. They are doing what we would call reconnaissance. Now bump up to chapter 6. Again, not trying to go into high level of detail, trying to get organization at this point. If you go up to chapter 6, this is his last vision of the evening. It was a long evening, I suspect. Then I looked again and saw four chariots, not four horses, four chariots. Horses with men on them go do reconnaissance. Chariots go to war. So he sees the four chariots coming from between the two mountains. The mountains were made of bronze. Somebody will say, well, which mountains? I don't know. I have an idea, though. I'll tell you later. The mountains were made of bronze. The first chariot had chestnut or red horses. The second one, black horses. The third, white horses. And the fourth, dappled or spotted horses. All strong horses. So I inquired of the angel who was speaking with me. There's our friend again who helps him understand. What are these, my lord? Now, he's not the man on the red horse. He's not the man that sent out the chariots. He's the angel who assists him in his night visions. This isn't the only place in Scripture where this happens. This kind of literature where the visions are very symbolic is called apocalyptic literature. God doesn't usually leave us guessing because he'll have an angel to help interpret, or in the case of the book of Revelation, all the allusions in the Revelation are to Old Testament passages. It helps us kind of connect. But look, he says, the angel said, these are the four spirits of heaven going out, presenting themselves to the Lord and the whole earth. And the one with the black horses is going to the land of the north. The white horses are going after them and so forth. My point is, you know, in the opening vision, the man on the horse sends out other horsemen and they come back and report. In this vision, he sends out chariots and they come back and report. In this way, the visions correspond, although they tell a different message. The first vision, the report back is basically the world is at peace and one has to ask, why is it at peace? And I'll contend that it's at peace because the Gentiles have overrun Israel. Israel's basically dead and gone, and with it all the hopes of a Messiah. And it's in that sense in which the world's at peace. This isn't like a time of no war. It's a time when Satan feels the thrill of victory, as it were. At the end, he sends out the chariots to go start cracking heads together. So that's just kind of like the first eight visions. And I haven't said anything about the ones in the middle. I'm just trying to get an organization. So I'll give it a little bit more organization and I'll come back. But is there a question yet, or have I just made this way too hard?
On the heels of the prophecy mentioned, this prophecy is going forward to Revelation. Was he red and black?
That's a good question. So the when you read Revelation 6, Jesus, you know, John is told that there, you know, the Father's on the throne. He has a scroll. John weeps because no one's able to, or worthy, I should say, to open the scroll. Then you see the Lamb who appears to have a mortal wound, yet he lives. God hands him the scroll. It has seven seals. Jesus begins popping the seals off. The first four have four horses of different colors. The language is from Zechariah 1. I'm not convinced the meaning is, but the language is from Zechariah 1. It's absolutely no question about it. I mean, it seems like he's pulled the language with the colored horses. But I don't think the meaning's the same. So chapter 6 has an epilogue, and I have an editor note here. It says crowning the branch. I should have mentioned who's in charge at the time. So Zechariah is the prophet, but two other key characters appear in this book, other than the one we've met already, the angel of the Lord, or the man who is riding the red horse. They're one and the same. You also have Zerubbabel. He's the governor, so he is the essentially the political leader of the nation that God has put in charge. And then you have Joshua, the high priest. He's an older high priest, but he's in charge in the line of Aaron, and he's going to be in charge of all the Levitical priests. Because to restore Israel, which is what the goal is here, you need to restore it physically and spiritually. And I should have read one key thing that happened in chapter 1 that really sets off these visions. If you look in chapter 1, after the other horsemen come back and report that the whole earth is calm, it says then in verse 12, the angel of the Lord responded, "How long, Lord of armies," or in some translations, "Lord of hosts," King James will say "Lord of hosts," "how long, Lord of hosts," meaning essentially host of soldiers, host of armies, "how long will you withhold mercy from Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that you have been angry with these," you see how many years? 70. That's Jeremiah's prophecy. Remember in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel was watching his calendar. He was marking off the years, and he had lived to be a ripe old age. He's in his 80s when he's thrown in the lion's den. He's not a child like all the little pictures we have kids doing Sunday school show. And he's hoping to live long enough to see his people go home. And so he asked in Daniel 9 in his prayer, "Lord, it's almost 70 years. I've got the book of Jeremiah in front of me." I mean, he says that. When are you going to free us up? This is referring back to that same prophecy. That they would both refer to it tells us a couple of things. One, Jeremiah was written way back then, not, you know, at 150 B.C. or something like that, like a lot of people now try to claim. It's a very old book, as was Daniel, as was Zechariah. But it's a proper question. Lord, you said 70 years of bondage. We're after the 70 years. The city's still in ruins. When will you show mercy to it? And listen, the Lord replied. So this is, it would seem, God the Father speaking to the man on the white horse who's been called the angel of the Lord. And he says he replies with kind and comforting words to the angel who is speaking with me. Who then, of course, maybe Zechariah hears it or the angel tells him. Those kind and comforting words are important. Zechariah's name means Yahweh remembers. He remembers his promises. His promise was that Israel had a glorious future. He told that to Abraham in Genesis 12. And despite being taken out of the land and despite the discipline in Babylon, they're back to receive a blessing. And these good and comforting words are that God is going to fix the situation in their country, which is really dire because, the whole city is just a lump of, or it's just, you know, stones. There's no wall. There's no temple. There's no houses until they started building theirs. It's in ruins. So those good and comforting words matter because God will restore the nation physically and spiritually. And that's why you need leaders like Zerubbabel, the governor, and Joshua, the high priest. When you get to chapter 6, to that prologue I was mentioning, this is why I went on that direction. Joshua is told to sit down, and Zechariah works with three other guys that came out of captivity, and they've got some gold and some jewels, and they fashion a crown for Joshua. But priests don't wear crowns. And when they fashion it, and it says, they put it on his head, verse 11, take the silver and the gold, make a crown, place it on the head of Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. You are to tell him, and listen to what they're going to tell him, because sometimes God uses a picture instead of a message. The whole book of Jonah, while historical, is a message. It's not a message for us to talk about missionary work to Nineveh. It's a message to Israel that the Ninevites repented at five little words, and you had all these prophets, and you didn't repent. And it's to convict them. And God often has his prophets do those kinds of things, do things that instead of speaking a message, you watch it or you see it. And so Zechariah, in a public way, puts a crown on the head of the high priest. Why would he do that? Why would you put a king's crown on a man that is not a king? He's a priest. He can't be a king. He's a Levite. Why would he do that? You're to tell him, this is what the Lord of hosts says. Here is a man whose name is Branch. Recognize that from anywhere else? In what way is Jesus the branch?
He says, I am the branch, you are the branches.
Well, in John 15, he talks about being essentially the part of the grapevine that goes into the ground that's rooted, and they're the branches off of that. But in an Old Testament sense, because John hadn't come along yet, the branch. This is used, and I don't have all the sites written here because I brought my Bible with no notes written in it. But there's a number of Old Testament prophetic usages of the branch. It's a messianic term for the coming branch that will be a branch off of David, who will be the Christ. And so when he says, behold the branch, the Jewish audience will realize he's supposed to be a picture of the Messiah. How would a high priest with a crown be a picture of Jesus? King of kings. And what else, though? A priest. What kind of priest? Just one of them in the ranks? The high priest, right? So much of the book of Hebrews, which is all of is a Christological treatise, right? Meaning it's like every chapter is deep theology about Jesus and what it means for him to be the Christ. And he spends three or four chapters talking about Jesus as the high priest. In fact, he has to defend the Jewish people. How could he be a priest if he's not a Levite? But they should have known this priest, of course, is just a picture of one to come. But the one to come would have to be a king. It's the reason, I know I'm gluing a lot of things together, but really stop me if I say something that you find heretical or you're like, what is he talking about? Peter says, to the beginning probably, Peter says in 1 Peter, choosing some words used in the Old Testament, he says, you're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood. And I think as Christians, we read that like it's just kind of flowery words. No, like he really means you're priest. And you got to say, wait a second. I got told in Sunday school there's no priest anymore. You're telling me we're a royal priesthood. Put the word priesthood aside for a moment. How can you be a royal priesthood? What does it mean to be a royal? You can't help but read about them every day if you open up Yahoo. because they still have some, they're supposed to be royals over there on the island, but right, but if you're royal, you're a king. Yeah. And so how is it we could be in a royal priesthood? Well, we've got a high priest whose picture here in Zechariah 6 is a high priest with a crown. And that's why much of Hebrews is arguing that Jesus is a priest. You know, like he's not the same as Aaron, who was Moses' brother, and then all the high priests, including Joshua here, they were in the line of Aaron. Jesus ain't in the line of Aaron. How can he possibly be a high priest? Do y'all remember, how does the Bible explain how he could be a high priest? Right, and she's not Levite. She's from the tribe of Judah. She can't be a priest. He's not a priest by birth. Levites are all priests by birth. He's not a priest by birth. How? The line of Melchizedek. Yes, that mysterious figure that appears two times in the Old Testament, Genesis 14 and one of the Psalms. I think it's Psalm 110, but it may be 102. But in any event, it's Genesis 14, one of the Psalms. And the author of Hebrews spends a lot of time belaboring the point. He wasn't born a priest. He was appointed a priest after the order of Melchizedek. It's a different priesthood, and it's a royal priesthood. It's interesting, in the first chapter of Revelation, he opens up and John says he's made us priests and kings. Why? Because we're a royal priesthood. We need to get that. And you say, well, if I'm a royal priesthood, what does that really mean? Paul would say that we're ministers of the new covenant. At the end of Jesus' life, knowing he would be arrested that evening, he held up the cup of wine and he said, this is the blood of the new covenant, because he knows tomorrow at 3 p.m. when he gives up the ghost and says, tetelestai, it's finished, he will bring to an end an old covenant, the one of Moses, and inaugurate a new covenant that is a covenant where he will be the high priest. The Levites no longer have that priestly role as of that moment. And this is what it's looking forward to. And this is one of the clearest indications in the Old Testament of a future, the branch, the Messiah. He'll branch out from his place and he'll build the Lord's temple. Oh, wow. Now, they're going to get a temple built within 4 or 5 years of when Zechariah is preaching. Zechariah will live to see it. That temple is gone. You can't go to it today. There's an Islamic mosque on it that's been there for several hundred years, where the temple should be. That mosque is not allowed to be there. God will remove it shortly. But God removed this temple as well in 70 AD. He brought the Romans to remove it because that generation of Israel largely rejected Christ. It's this temple they're building that this book is talking about that will still be standing, although Herod, we call him Herod the Great, that tried to kill Jesus in Bethlehem, he will much have improved it. But it will be this temple centuries later getting destroyed. So Jesus is going to build a future temple. It's the Lord's temple. He, the branch, and I'm suggesting that's Jesus, he will wear royal splendor. He'll bear royal splendor. He will sit on his throne and rule, and by implication, the throne is in the temple. In other words, it's not a mere manifestation of God in the temple like the one that they would have. Why you had the Holy of Holies and the Ark of the Covenant, and it's kind of a manifestation of God, like God's actually going to be there, like physically sitting there. And it says there will be a priest on his throne. That's never happened before, right? Except one time. And that's Melchizedek in Genesis 14, who is called the King of Salem and a priest. Right? It's never happened. So anyway, just to say, this is a big deal. And what I'm suggesting now is all the 8-night visions are to lead up to this. The crowning achievement of the 8-night visions is to keep pointing us to a Messiah that will be a king priest. And in a minute, I'll dig a little more into the 8-night visions, but let me quickly talk about the rest of the organization of the book. 7 and 8 are hinge chapters. They have a fascinating historical... they have some prophecy, but they have some historical stuff. And what happens at the beginning of chapter 7 is there are people who come from Bethel. In the Old Testament, after the kingdom had split, you had north and south, and the north was bad the whole time. Like, they never had a good king. And the reason I say they were bad, the Jewish people were required to worship in Jerusalem. It wasn't an option for them. They were to travel there to worship a few times a year, and they didn't. They set up their own kind of fake Jerusalem with fake temple and fake practices and all that. And a lot of that was seated at Bethel. When I preached on Amos a couple of weeks ago, it was the priest at Bethel, Amaziah, who told Amos, "You better go home and not preach here anymore." So it was a seat of idolatry. And now it's not. Now there's no idolatry in Bethel. And the men from Bethel come to Zechariah and some of the other priests that are in Jerusalem to ask a question about whether they should continue doing the fast, right, going without eating, that they had done for the 70 years of captivity. They weren't fast that the Bible said these are days you have to fast. They were new fast that had become a tradition. And they come and say, do we still have to fast? And then that question doesn't get answered until chapter 8. It's kind of an interesting. God like organizes it that way. He lets them ask the question, and then he does things like in chapter 8, he has this wonderful passage about the future. I mean, look at chapter 8, verse 1. The Lord of hosts says, "I'm extremely jealous for Zion," that'll be Jerusalem. "I'm jealous for her with a great wrath." That means if someone comes to try to bring you harm, I'm going to take them out. That's pretty cool. That doesn't stay that way forever, but it was true at this time. "I will return to Zion and live in Jerusalem." That's not like ministerially speaking. That's like literally speaking. "I will dwell there. I will personally be there." Then Jerusalem will be called the faithful city. That's never happened yet. They're not faithful and they haven't been called the faithful city. The mountain of the Lord of armies will be called the holy mountain. So you have this stuff. And then he goes on. Look what he says in verse 4. The Lord of armies says, "Old men and old women will sit along the streets of Jerusalem, each with their staff in hand because of advanced age." Why? One, they're living longer. And two, they have absolute peace and security. Right? People were dying in ancient Jerusalem because armies like Nebuchadnezzar's came in. And if you were elderly, they're just going to kill you because you're no use to them. And now these people are living to advanced ages in safety because Jesus is personally going to be there to ensure their safety. And this will all come to roost, especially in chapter 14. Absolutely.
So, I'm just a little confused. The third temple. Okay, this is the new temple coming down. The third temple.
Well, I won't make it my hill to die on about the different temples, but Ezekiel spends like 8 chapters teaching about a future temple that would be during the millennium. That's the temple that I read about earlier in chapter 6. Joshua will see the temple in his day built, but it is a shadow of things to come. And there will be a temple in the millennium from which Jesus will rule. There may be a temple that is built very rapidly and destroyed during the tribulation period.
I'm just hung up on that desolation part. Is that
in Matthew 24? Jesus in Matthew 24 alludes to Daniel, okay, when he talks about the abomination of desolation. I believe he's looking forward to a temple that will exist in the tribulation period. And it's not the one Jesus is going to rule and reign from. Because when he rules and reigns from it, ain't nobody taking it.
So maybe Armageddon, that gets destroyed.
And there's a new temple built.
Oh.
Yeah. And that temple's the one, like he says it like repeatedly in this book of Zechariah. And we'll see a little more of it, that I am going to dwell in the midst of you, and like in chapter 6, in that temple. And here, I just want you to get the sense, and of course, this looks forward to a golden age that Jesus will usher in. But, so people are in the streets, they're each with a staff in their hand for advanced age. The streets of the city are filled with boys and girls playing. Why? Because they're in security. Their parents aren't making them hide in the house. The Lord of armies says this: "Though it may seem impossible to the remnant of these people, in those days should it also seem impossible to me." See, he wants to motivate the people by taking them to a distant future. and telling them how the story ends and telling them who wins. And it's his way of saying, now get to work and finish the temple. Rebuild the city, but rebuild your spirituality as Jewish people. And this is the glorious future ahead of you. They don't understand all the timing, but they can understand God's going to bless the nation. We get the benefit of having all 66 books. We can do some looking back. These two chapters are a historical hinge. They have all that meat in the middle where God promises this glorious future. And then God returns at the end of 8 and answers the question about fasting. And he says, look, you guys have been fasting, but you never did it for me. Look at that. Never did it for me. Verse 18, chapter 8. The word of the Lord of armies came to me. That's Zechariah. The Lord of armies said this. The fast of the fourth month, the fast of the fifth month, and the fast of the seventh month, and the fast of the tenth will become times of joy, gladness, and cheerful festivals. They were fasting because of great sadness. It was lamenting not only the fall of Jerusalem, but some other specific things. Each fast had a specific purpose. But it was a time of grieving. And God says, I'm turning that all around. These are going to be celebrations now. Therefore, love truth and peace. And he goes on and says, peoples will yet come, the residents of many cities. The resident of one city will go to another, saying, let's go at once to plead for the Lord's favor and to seek the Lord of hosts. I am going. Many people and strong nations, this is all during the millennial kingdom, nations from around the world, and he'll pick this back up in Zechariah 14, the nations from around the world, people will travel during this thousand-year period to Jerusalem to literally seek from Jesus, because he'll be there. They'll come to seek the Lord of armies in Jerusalem and to plead for the Lord's favor. And he says this, in those days, 10 men from the nations of every language, this is Gentiles. The Jewish people had this Jewish-centric view of the Scripture, but it wasn't based on the Scripture itself. They're surprised. I mean, Peter in the book of Acts has to see a dream about unclean animals on a sheet floating down from heaven to get him to go preach to Cornelius, because Cornelius is a Gentile and Gentiles are dogs. But this book says that the Gentiles are going to be part of God's people. See? And in those days, from every tribe and, you know, every nation of every language, that's Revelation picks up that language, every tribe, every nation. They'll grab the robe of a Jewish man tightly, urging, let us go with you, for we've heard that God is with you. Now, the part I skipped over just before that was when he said, let's see if I can find one verse for you. Let's see. I've missed it here. About the fasting. Oh, well. I shall leave that behind, though. Because I don't see it. And I know it's in there in either chapter 7 or 8. But he will answer and basically say, have you fasted for me? It may have been at the beginning of 7. Is it? Okay, yeah. He says in 7:6, you're right, when you eat and drink, did you eat and drink simply for yourselves? He's calling their motives into question. And I thought the answer came later, but I guess I was wrong. The answer is fascinating, though, because it does tell you, like, your attitudes and worship matter. And especially when you fast. You can understand why Jesus in the New Testament would say, don't, like, when you're fasting, disfigure your face so everybody will know you're fasting. Just do it, don't tell anybody. A buddy of mine growing up, his grandmother would fast a lot, at least she claimed to, and she always called to tell him that, don't invite me to dinner today because I'm fasting. And it's like that's exactly what he said don't do. Well, the last two pieces of this, just organization-wise, 10, 11, and 12 constitute a single, they read like more than one message, but they constitute a single, what's called a burden. And then 12, 13, and 14 are a second burden. So we have 8 night visions, a hinge chapter that kind of deals with this historical matter of the men from Bethel coming and asking about fasting. And then you have 9, 10, and 11 is a burden. And you see how he starts chapter 9 by saying, a pronouncement, how it translates here. Does anyone have there say burden? Thank you. Okay, because I'm using the CSB after using the King James for 25 years, and I've memorized it in the King James in that sense. But the word is a burden, and a pronouncement is not a good translation. It's a burden. It's a heavy weight to get off his shoulders. And 9, 10, and 11 are a burden, and then 12, 13, 14. What's interesting about 9, so I'll just high level, we know something about 9, because 9 is the triumphal entry chapter. Zechariah 9, verse 9. Foretells the triumphal entry. It's a lot of folks would take the first 8 verses there. If you read them, they show a man bringing an army through the neighboring countries and regions all the way up to Jerusalem. And it's widely held that that is Alexander the Great, because he takes a similar path. I don't accept that view, but I mean, it is widely held among those who are premillennial. I think it's not a good fit. But nevertheless, I think God, in what we the battle we would call Armageddon, will destroy these surrounding nations, and then this triumphal entry, in a sense, will happen again. It's happened once. Verse 9 has happened. Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout in triumph, daughter Jerusalem. Look, your king is coming to you. He's righteous and victorious, humble and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. All four Gospels have that. It's one of the handful of things, other than the actual crucifixion and resurrection, that all four Gospels have. But verse 10 is what threw the people off in the first century, because verse 10 says, I'll cut off the chariot from Ephraim. This continues the battle, the first 8 verses. It continues the victory. Jesus didn't cut off chariots from Ephraim at all. Ephraim is just another way of saying the northern Samaria, or the northern part of the country. It's Israel, but the northern part. He didn't get rid of the chariots and the horses from Jerusalem. This is why when they threw the palm branches down, they knew verse 9. And by the way, they knew Zechariah 14. That's why they threw the palm branches down. Zechariah 14 says when Messiah comes, the world will come and celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, where you use palm branches to build little booths and you stay in them. And so that's why when they saw Jesus coming in and he had raised Lazarus 2 days earlier, they start throwing the palm leaves down. That has nothing to do with the Passover. That's the Tabernacles. It's very clear in the text. They went and started cutting palm leaves because you got the wrong festival altogether. They start throwing them down because they knew verse 10. I will cut off the chariots. They're looking around at those Roman soldiers thinking, now you're in for it. This is the Messiah. They knew Zechariah. And that's why we have the triumphal entry, because they were keen on this prophecy. And so this stuff from 10 on, that would await when Jesus returns, as we read it in Revelation 19, he does crack heads together. And Revelation 19 is largely taken for the 14th chapter of this book. Chapter 10, great chapter. Chapter about blessings. Again, he's motivating people largely through the promise of future blessings. A coming Messiah coming down the Mount of Olives with salvation. Humble with salvation, riding on a donkey. A coming Messiah who will live in your midst in Jerusalem, who will build a temple there. And he keeps adding the blessings. Chapter 10 opens up, ask the Lord for rain. Well, we don't have to think hard to understand that, given the kind of rain we've had lately, right? This isn't pray for rain and maybe you'll get some. This is pray for rain. It's a done deal. Because Jesus is ruling and reigning during the millennium. You need some rain? Ask him for some rain. You'll get some rain. And so it's chapter 10 is a blessing chapter. Chapter 9 told us Jesus would come, but we know it has to do with two comings. They wouldn't have known it then. They would have naturally, and all of us would, have thought he comes and then he starts getting rid of the soldiers and the chariots and all that. But we know there's a space of time between it. Chapter 11 starts to give you an idea of why that might be. Chapter 11 talks about two shepherds, and he has Zechariah play the role of a good shepherd, because God had sent good shepherds to them. They're much like the United States. We just refuse to vote in a good shepherd. And if you gave us a good shepherd, we wouldn't know what to do with him. And so Zechariah goes in as a good shepherd, and they won't have anything to do with him.
And then he plays the role of a bad shepherd, and they love him. Okay? Even though the bad shepherd eats the sheep. Right? The shepherd isn't really supposed to eat his own sheep. And so you see this. He starts off, the first few verses have kind of an introduction that speak of a consuming fire, as if the enemy is approaching through Lebanon to the borders of Israel. Open your gates, Lebanon. That's figurative. Lebanon doesn't have gates. It's a region of land. But it's as if all the defenses are down and the army can march through and burn everything in their wake. Fire will consume your cedars. They were known for the big cedar trees. They used those to build the temple. Now he talks to the trees themselves. They're personified. Well, cypress, for the cedar has fallen. Why would you talk to a tree and talk about trees falling? Because the nation's being overrun. And perhaps it's kings and such. And so you speak to the cypress tree and you tell it to cry or to wail because the cedars have fallen. Well, oaks of Bashan. Bashan was a rich, fertile area in Israel, by the way, in the northern kingdom. And he tells them that for the oak trees to cry out, for the stately forest has fallen, presumably due to the fire. Listen to the wall of the shepherds, for their glory is destroyed. The kings and the princes are losing their power, maybe their lives. And then God says, though, in verse 4, the Lord my God says this, shepherd the flock intended for slaughter. Ow. Those who buy them slaughter them but are not punished. Those who sell them say, blessed be the Lord because I have become rich. This is a lot like the kind of things we would read in Amos. People will give God a blessing when they're able to make money destroying other people. And he tells Zechariah to shepherd the flock that's destined for a slaughter. I think the people at that time that he speaks to haven't like turned bad yet. But he can see a later generation. And we think of the first generation the first century generation, that they now become the sheep destined for slaughter, and they get slaughtered in AD 70. I think it looks forward to a good shepherd that they won't have anything to do with. Look what he says. So I shepherded the flock intended for slaughter. Zechariah somehow plays out the role. There's a big debate about whether he literally went among the people and had a staff in his hand and said, I'm going to shepherd you, or whether he saw all this in a vision. But he goes and he has two staffs. He calls one favor and the other union. Favor of God, the union of the different tribes of Israel. And I shepherded the flock. In 1 month, I got rid of 3 shepherds. I've read 40 books on Zechariah, and nobody has any idea who the 3 shepherds are. So I'm not going to tell you. I have no idea. But I know one thing, he got rid of them. I became impatient with them, and they also detested me. This means he killed them. And it's very unlikely that Zechariah actually killed somebody. It's more likely, I would argue, but again, not dogmatic, that this is in a vision where he participates in the vision. In all the night visions, and we didn't get to like look at each one in any detail, but he does participate in them. Like he has a role in them. It's not just like he's watching a movie. But it goes more than that. I became impatient with them. They detested me. Then I said, I will no longer shepherd you. Let what is dying die, and let what is perishing perish. Let the rest devour each other's flesh. Then I took my staff called favor of God, and cut it in two, annulling the covenant I had made with all the peoples. It was annulled on that day, so the oppressed of the flock who were watching me knew that it was the word of the Lord. Then I said to them, if it seems right to you, give me my wages, but if not, keep them. So they weighed my wages, 30 pieces of silver. Ah, and see, now it starts to tie together. And the New Testament calls this back. It's what Judas got. Zechariah, in his vision, he's faithfully ministered to the people. He shepherded the people. And he goes to the people and says, I'm quitting, but give me my check, right? Everybody probably at some point had a job that they take this job and shove it, but give me my check. And that's what he did. And he cashed in. He got 30 pieces of silver, right? It's slave's wage. I don't know if that really matters. People build a lot on that. Nothing here is said. It's not a small sum of money, but it kind of depends who did the work, right?
If you paid me to paint a portrait for you, 30 pieces of silver might not be a good bargain for you. Michelangelo did it, then you've underpaid him, right? If Christ was the shepherd, you've grossly underpaid him. He then plays the role, he says, throw it to the potter, which happens in the New Testament. And then he plays the role, looking in verse 15, take the equipment of a foolish shepherd. Having killed the Christ, who will lead them? Well, a lot of bad people will, but eventually the Antichrist will. And the foolish shepherd, the bad or wicked shepherd, Zechariah plays out the role, but just as he was symbolic of a good shepherd, he's not himself the good shepherd, he's symbolic of a bad shepherd. And he says, I'm going to raise a bad shepherd up in the land who will not care for those who are perishing. And he will not seek the lost. Jesus came to seek and save the lost. See where this stuff's, you know. He will not heal the broken. Jesus came to heal up the broken, to cause the blind to see and the lame to walk. He will not sustain the healthy, but he will devour the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hooves so he can get the meat out of there or whatever's in there. So, but chapter 12, this tremendous turning point. Look in verse 10 of chapter 12. This begins the new burden. The first three, great. Messiah comes, triumphal entry. Chapter 10, day of blessing in the kingdom. You ask for rain, you get rain, right? You ask for smoked meat, you get smoked meat. It's great. And then chapter 11, though, there's a good shepherd who's going to be rejected by the people. Who will he be? He doesn't answer all the questions yet, but he begins unfolding them. There's a bad shepherd the people will embrace. Now, chapter 12, there has to be a time of spiritual restoration. And there will be that time. We struggle with why did so many Jewish people reject Christ in the first century? That's largely why the book of Matthew was written, to address a Jewish audience and help them understand. But Zechariah 12 looks forward to a time of national revival among the Jewish people. 12:10 says, and I know I'm starting in the middle, but just because we're running out of time, and I want you to get these highlights. Then I, this is God speaking, will pour out a spirit of grace and prayer or supplication in the old translations. A supplication is when you ask for something from God. I'll pour out a spirit of grace and prayer on the house of David and the residents of Jerusalem. They'll look at me whom they pierced. This is a common passage that's been used to bring Jewish people to Christ. You need to understand, Jewish people don't read their Bible in general. I'm not going to broad brush that, but they, if they read it, they're looking at Torah or something else like the Mishnah and the Talmud. They're not looking at the prophets. The prophets are almost never read. Let's face it, Baptists don't read the prophets. We shouldn't be surprised that Jewish people don't either. But if they did, they would find Jesus all over it. He says, they'll look at me whom they've pierced. Listen to how they mourn or grieve. They'll mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, a child. The older translations will say son. They'll mourn as one mourns for their only son and weep bitterly for him as one weeps for a firstborn. On that day, mourning in Jerusalem will be as great as the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo. That Megiddo is the area from which we get the word Armageddon. The land will mourn. The land doesn't cry, but it's symbolic of all the people crying and mourning. Every family by itself, the family of David's house, and it basically goes down to the Levites, everybody else, the rich people, the poor people, in verse 14, all the remaining people, every family, the men and the women by themselves. Now there's deep spirituality. What are they mourning? They killed the Christ. This national revival is what's going to save their bacon. In Matthew 24, Jesus says, when you get to the end times, and you're going to have a lot of people saying the Christ is here and the Christ is there, don't listen to them, because when I return, every person on the planet is going to know it. It's going to be a very public thing, and no one's going to mistake it. But you're going to have all these deceivers. When you start seeing these things, he says, run for the hills, basically. Literally the mountains, but they're hills in Jerusalem. And hide. And he says, don't go pack your clothes. Hope it's not the Sabbath, because you can't catch a cab on the Sabbath. Hope it's not that you're nursing a baby. It's going to be hard to run with a baby. Just leave everything and run for physical safety. What's going to happen when they run? Revelation records some of what happens. but a good part of it's here in 14 that we'll just very quickly grasp onto. But understand, they are going to call out on Jesus. It's going to be this remnant that runs. They're going to call out on Jesus to save them, not to save their souls. That's already happened. To save them from the enemy that's chasing them. Pharaoh chased them to the Red Sea. God held them up, the Pharaoh's army, split the Red Sea, brought them through, then closed the sea on the enemy. Jesus in Zechariah 14 will split the Mount of Olives, bring the people through, let the army come, and then bust heads together. That's a lot of stuff packed into 14. And you're like, it's Exodus happening all over again. This resonates with the Jewish people. And they're going to call out on the name of the Lord, Romans 10, Joel chapter 2, verse 32, call out on the name of the Lord and you'll be saved. That's not a salvation passage for an invitation. It's these people calling out on Jesus Christ. Jesus said in Matthew 23, you're not going to see me again until you say what? Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Which, by the way, is what they said at the triumphal entry. If you read what they actually said, besides Hosanna, which means deliver us from the Romans, right? They said, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. But it seems like a lot of them didn't mean it. When they say it again and they mean it, he's going to deal with them. This is national revival. This is the Jewish nation, not every last person, but a bunch of them, seeing who Jesus is, realizing that he was the Christ. Chapter 13 is a spiritual chapter that talks about their spiritual cleansing. But I just want you to see one verse, and that's verse 7. God says, sword, awake against my shepherd, against the man who is my, I hate this translation, it says associate, the man who is my peer. How many peers does God have? Well, if you think of a Trinity, yes, too. But God is one. God, you know, there's no equal to God. He's saying against the man who is my equal. What time when would the sword be awakened against my shepherd? Which shepherd? The one we met in chapter 11, right? The good shepherd. And again, who is my peer, my equal? This is the declaration of the Lord of hosts. Listen to this: strike the shepherd, and sheep will be scattered. That's in the New Testament. That's what happened on, at least by my reckoning, on a Friday. But whenever it happened on a Roman cross, and just understand, he does that. And then as the chapter closes, he talks about when he returns. He gets into the millennium, verse 8. In the whole land, this is the Lord's declaration, two-thirds will be cut off and die. Two-thirds of Israel, the Jewish people. But a third will be left in it. What will they do? They're going to run for the hills. That's the remnant he will save. Well, chapter 14, and we are out of time, but I want to say something about 14. Because this is like the pinnacle chapter. Everything is moving toward this. And it's just to say this. It starts with the enemies of Israel have overrun the city of Jerusalem. He says, look, a day belonging to the Lord. In other words, a day God knows and we don't. But there are people that write books who seem to know what day this will be. And Jesus got asked, he didn't know. Don't buy those books because they don't know. But if they think they know, then they think they always do, right? The day is coming, and look, a day belonging to the Lord is coming. When the plunder taken from you will be divided in your presence, I will gather this. You know, that verse first isn't very encouraging to people who are listening to it. Now, they don't know when this is going to happen. This is enemies coming and stealing your stuff. That's exactly what they're worried about. They have no wall. They have no army. What does he say? I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem for battle. The nations aren't coming to do war with Jesus. They probably think they're coming as a rebellion against Antichrist. While he is a global leader, like all global leaders, there can be a mutiny on the ship. And they're probably coming after him, but they don't know. God says, you know, really, I'm bringing you. I'm baiting you to come here so I can smack all of you at one time. The city will be captured. Which city? Jerusalem. That's why Jesus says in Matthew 24 to run. He knows it's going to be captured. When it's captured, what will happen? The houses looted and the women raped. I've been reading an audio book called 1776. It's a history book by David McCullough, who passed away a few weeks ago. And it is a fabulous history book. But we know so little of the American Revolution, at least from what I ever learned in school. this is what armies do, and that's what they did. When the British took Boston, that's what they did. When the British took New York, that's what they did. All this stuff. This is warfare, how it's been for centuries. And that's why Jesus says you don't want to be in the city because you're worried about protecting your house from being looted. You will get hurt there. You may be killed there. And so he tells them to run. Now you see how you can connect Matthew 24 to this. The city will be captured. The houses, okay, half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be removed from the city. Then the Lord will go out to fight against those nations as he fights on the day of battle. This is the Armageddon battle. This is Revelation 19, where he pulls the sword out of his mouth, which is a way of saying that he speaks the words that destroy them. I think he probably says something like, die. And that's it. He's actually going to do it here. Look in verse 5. Well, hold on. Let me read this. Verse 4. Now remember, Acts chapter 1, around verse 8, Jesus ascends into heaven. The angels are talking to the disciples saying, why are you standing around staring into heaven? He's going to come back in the same way. Not only in the same way, but he's going to come back to the same place. Okay? And on that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. This is giving very concrete details about the return of Christ and what that event will look like. Sometime near the end of the tribulation period, when it seems like the Jewish people have nowhere left to run, he returns, plants his feet on the Mount of Olives, which is where Matthew 24 is preached from. That's why we call it the Olivet Discourse. It says, which faces Jerusalem on the east, and that's true. That's where it looks down at. Looks down at the Temple Mount. The Mount of Olives will be split in half from east to west, forming a huge valley so that half of the mountain will move to the north and half to the south. Just like splitting the Red Sea, he's done this thing before. Verse 5, you, the remnant, will flee by my mountain valley. See how he's making an escape where there was none? Why? They went over dry land. You know how hard it is to climb a mountain? I went to Mount Zion National Park and I took the toddler tour and I about killed myself. Okay? It was tough. And I was only, I thought I'd been out there for hours, and you get back to the car and you're about to die in like 35 minutes. You know? How are these people, some carrying children, some people who you know, they're not 20 years old, okay? And how are they going to make such a clean getaway? Because he's going to make a flat road. A valley, right? And you will flee by my mountain valley, for the valley of the mountain will extend to Azal. We have no idea where that's at. You will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of King Uzziah of Judah. That's the earthquake I mentioned from the very first book in the first verse in the book of Amos a couple weeks back. That earthquake was more than 200 years before this, but it was such a profound event that everybody knew about it. It was like saying 9/11. Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him. And that's what I was saying earlier. They're going to be escaping, as he said in Matthew 24 and as he told them to do here, through this valley that Jesus will personally make for them. And then he will come. And I think somewhere in there, they're going to be saying, Jesus, save us. You know, a short way of saying that would be Hosanna. Yeah. And then he's going to appear. On that day, there will be no light. The sunlight, the moonlight will diminish. It will be a unique day known only to the Lord. That's why people that write books tell you when it's going to be are so funny. Without day or night, there will be a light at evening. Light at evening, interesting. That's like that time in Joshua when the sun stayed out a really long time, so he'd have more daylight for killing. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half of it toward the eastern sea. What sea is east of Jerusalem? A Dead Sea. Yeah. There's a reason the Dead Sea exists, right? So that Jesus can make it a living sea. Yeah. And the other half toward the western sea, that's the Mediterranean. In order for this river to flow that way, the current topography of Israel will not suffice. He's going to have to do some changes, some modifications, but that's what you do when you get a new house. On that day, the Lord will become king over the whole earth. That is literal. And the Lord alone and his name alone. You realize that this is not a democracy where they don't get to vote for him. All the land from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, will be changed into a plain. That was my topographical changes I was suggesting. he comes back to the wicked people, the nations he has to do war with. Look in verse 12. This will be the plague with which the Lord strikes all the people who have warred against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. This answers the question of exactly what happens when Jesus pulls the sword out of his mouth, which is for speaking wrath, for speaking destruction in Revelation 19. This is what actually happens. I don't know what exactly that's going to be like other than what's described here, but it sounds like it's a flesh-eating thing that's going to happen so rapidly that it's going to deal with their body before they hit the ground. On that day, great panic from the Lord will be among them. I would expect so. So that each will seize the hand of another, and the hand of one will rise against another. Judah will also fight at Jerusalem. So the Jewish people will fight and so forth. The wealth of the nations will be collected. That's what happened in the first Exodus. They took all the wealth from Egypt. The gold, the silver, the clothing. The same plague as the previous one will strike the horses, mules, camels, donkeys, and all the animals. And then the last thing is to say that he goes on and explains that people will come from around the world to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, to worship the king and keep, he says, Feast of Shelters in my translation of verse 16. So my one last comment, and then I know we're out of time, but if you have a question, I'm happy to try to answer it before they kick us out. Two real popular chapters here are chapters 3 and 4. And 3 is all about, if you go read it later, it's all about the high priest Joshua, and it's this fabulous scene where Satan accuses him of being inadequate to be the high priest, and Jesus says, put on him a change of raiment. It pictures salvation because he just gives him clean clothes where he had none before. It's not that the high priest is spiritually qualified in and of himself. He's qualified because Jesus says so. And Zechariah participates and puts gets a headpiece put on him because a high priest had to have a headpiece. And the headpiece said, holiness to the Lord on it. And so he gets all that. And then in chapter, so this is kind of like God blessing Joshua, saying, listen, I'm telling you, this temple is going to get done. These people are going to be reconstituted as a spiritual nation. And he's encouraging them. In verse 4, or chapter 4 rather, is about Zerubbabel. And it's kind of the same thing. And in chapter 4, though, it's the elevation, the exaltation of Zerubbabel. And he makes this probably the second best known thing said in Zechariah, not by might nor by power, but by my strength, saith the Lord. It'll be not the strength of Zerubbabel, and is his own self, but the power of the Spirit of God in his life. And these two chapters are the middle of the chiasm, a high priest and a king who together will function in a proper way to bring the restoration of the people. They picture the coming priest-king, those two men together, which is why chapter 6, I showed you earlier, has him being crowned. Chapter 4 ends with these words, these are the two anointed ones, he said, who stand by the Lord of the whole earth. You see what a profound that thing that would be to tell them? Because they're looking at a pile of stones, and God's saying, build it. Build a temple. And God tells them at the end of this, you guys are the two I've picked for this job. Standing before the Lord of the whole earth, you can't fail. Okay? Pretty powerful statement to them. I mean, that's kind of what, not just here, but I mean,